to do destroy fields and to you know persuade the farmers to produce you know corn or wheat or something like that. But it was not very successful, and it was never really a concerted effort on the part of the authorities to do that.
The Russian official added that the war crippled Afghanistan's economy, throwing it back decades. The United States has been training Afghan government forces for the past 20 years. Out of 300,000 Afghan troops, 22,000 have been commandos that Washington says have received special training. Despite that, the Taliban managed to sweep through the nation in a matter of days and seize the capital, Kabul, faster than anybody had anticipated. The rapid rate at which Afghan cities fell to the militant group also stunned Pentagon officials.
They had the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
According to Russia's security chief, Nikolai Petrushev, the West was never able to train the army, police, and security services of Afghanistan, as the number of attacks in Afghanistan have increased significantly after foreign forces were deployed to the country.
The Taliban, during the course of the time the United States was so-called in charge in Afghanistan, and really they controlled only a small part of the country. They were never in control of the entire country. Much of this, much of the Taliban influence was still making itself felt in various parts, especially in the region, some of the mountainous regions that often were inaccessible to large-scale military intervention. And the fact that that was an ongoing fight in which the Taliban were pitted against the official Afghani forces, then it seems reasonable that these would increase to the extent that they still felt themselves at war with a foreign power.
Petrushev added that the reported 40,000 civilian deaths since 2001 in Afghanistan has been understated, and that the figure doesn't include tens of thousands of Afghan troops that have been killed over the years. The Russian security official concluded that the staggering number of deaths is a result of the U.S. interference in the domestic affairs of other countries.
A shocking United Nations climate report has sounded a serious warning about global warming, saying that humans are explicitly to blame for irreversible climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described the report as a code red for humanity and urged an end to the use of coal and fossil fuels. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has concluded that the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal of the Paris Agreement would likely be breached by 2030, a decade sooner than it projected just 3 years ago. Countries should also end all new fossil fuel exploration and production and shift fossil fuel subsidies into renewable energy. The alarm bells are deafening and the evidence is irrefutable. Greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel burning and deforestation are choking our planet and putting billions of people at immediate risk. He also added that the report makes clear that there is no time for delay and no room for excuses. The IPCC report came just 3 months before a major UN climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland, where nations will be under pressure to pledge vigorous climate action and significant financing. The UN climate report draws on more than 14,000 scientific studies and offers the most comprehensive and detailed portrait yet of how climate change is altering the natural world and what could still lie ahead.
This is like a big rock rolling downhill. You can't just say, oh my goodness, there's a big rock and stop it. It is a process that starts and keeps going, and it is not possible to stop it. We can deflect it, and we're not even doing a good job of that, but there are things we could do.
Almost every nation on Earth signed up to the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. This pact aims to keep the rise in global temperatures well below 2 degrees Celsius this century and to pursue efforts to keep it under 1.5 degrees Celsius. This new report says that under all the emission scenarios considered by the scientists, both targets will be broken this century unless huge cuts in carbon take place. The authors believe that 1.5 degrees Celsius will be reached by 2040 in all scenarios. If emissions aren't slashed in the next few years, this will happen even earlier. Scientists further warn that warming of more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average could trigger runaway climate change.
One of the things that could happen that is in the fat chance list, but it could, is that all the big corporations could say, we are on a war footing now against climate change. Everyone needs to cut their consumption of everything, and we are going to cut our production because we need to do that or we will not have a planet to live on.
With catastrophic impacts, such as heat so intense that crops fail or people die just from being outdoors. According to the Carbon Majors report, only 100 companies have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since 1988. ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron are identified as among the highest emitting investor-owned companies since 1988.
That we should tell the companies, you can't do this. Not only should we prosecute, we should chop them off at the ankles, tell them they can't keep using resources and they can't keep going on with what they're doing. We will not allow them to keep producing and using resources and killing the planet.
It is expected that water problems like droughts, with its accompanying wildfires and flooding, are likely to become much worse around the world as climate breakdown takes hold. The effects will be felt across the globe, from the US, where drought is an increasing problem in the West and South, to India, where the monsoon may become more variable. Sub-Saharan Africa is also likely to experience increased drought in many areas, while flooding and drought will hit China and Europe.
Lebanon seems to be on the brink of an abyss as it grapples with a prolonged double crisis. Lebanon has been plagued by a political vacuum as politicians fail to agree on a government, while a devastating economic meltdown has become an existential threat. The situation has been widely described as the worst in Lebanon's history, with some warning that time is running out fast for those who wish to save the country. Lebanon has been without a government for a year now. The last government resigned in August 2020, days after a massive chemical blast destroyed much of the port of Beirut. The financial crisis has seen the Lebanese pound sink by more than 90% and pushed more than half of the population into poverty. The Lebanese Central Bank recently scrapped a fuel subsidy due to lack of funds. Lebanon is right now suffering from a painful fuel shortage that has caused long lines at petrol stations and worsened blackouts. Last week, over 24 people were killed when a fuel tanker exploded as people scrambled to fill gasoline in plastic containers. There have been warnings that the fuel crisis may soon force hospitals, bakeries, and other essential facilities to shut down. The grave situation has become a serious threat to the nation. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has begun acting in a bid to resolve the crisis. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has warned against any effort to block the transfer of Iranian fuel to Lebanon. Nasrallah has warned Israel and the U.S. to stay away from ships carrying the much-needed fuel for Lebanon. The Hezbollah chief says the tankers coming to Lebanon from Iran are Lebanese territory. The resistance movement has been a key player in Lebanese politics for many years and has gained popularity for its stance against Israel. The movement is very much despised by the West, especially the U.S., which is the closest ally of Israel. Western countries have imposed sanctions on Lebanon in a bid to limit Hezbollah's influence. The sanctions have played a major role in triggering the current financial meltdown. The resistance movement's ongoing effort to ease economic hardship in Lebanon will probably improve the situation to some extent. But observers believe any effective solution for the crisis needs cooperation by all Lebanese political parties. This week, Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati expressed optimism that a government could soon be formed. But on Thursday, Aoun said certain parties are blocking the formation of a new cabinet to push the country into chaos. Lebanon seems to need a competent government more than anything else at this point. Any further delay in forming a new government could have devastating consequences.
This is A to Z. Today's lesson, beware of sensuality. Undoubtedly, internal enemies are more dangerous than external foes. Therefore, obstinate desires, which affect man inwardly, are considered as the most dangerous enemy for man. Sensuality blinds the eye and deafens the ear. It extinguishes the light of wisdom, distorts the face of truth, and finally leads a man to the precipice of corruption. This is probably why Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, who is the sixth infallible Imam, has said, "Beware of sensual desires in the same way as you watch out of your obstinate enemies, because man has no enemies greater than following sensual desires and the outcomes of his tongue." So, brothers and sisters, it is time for us to introspect. It is time for us to reflect. It is time for us to use our intellect and our wisdom and evaluate whether we are stuck in fulfilling our sensual desires or do we have a higher purpose to our lives. Well, guess what? If we are honest to ourselves, most of the times, most of us are going to reach a conclusion that most of us are, or let me talk about myself, right? We are stuck in this quagmire of fulfilling our sensual desires. And Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam has already warned us to watch out for these internal sensual desires in the same way as you watch out from your staunch enemies. So let's take our sensual desires to be our staunch enemies.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing sensuality and how it can work against us, against our development, against our progress, against everything that we are supposed to accomplish in this lifetime. The question we need to ask ourselves is, are we stuck with our sensual desires or not? Well, in this process, Islam has much to offer. In Islam's view, prevention is the best cure. Islam offers a system of human-to-human relations and social life that is devoid of sexualization. Prevention of sexual objectification in society, according to Islam, includes the forbidding of any lustful, sensual gaze among men and women, men and men, and women and women. Other measures include dress code, which is known as hijab in case of women. Men and women are also advised to avoid casual relationships and keep all social intimacy among close relatives. Sexual relations are strictly limited to marriage. These commandments together offer a holistic system, and this is very important, brothers and sisters. We're discussing this while we have a bird's eye view, and once you listen to this sentence, you will understand what I'm trying to say. These commandments in Islam together offer a holistic system that ensures the health of society so that men and women can both perform their functions and have the opportunity to reach their potential. This full potential is what we are after. So hope, inshallah, we will be aware of our sensuality. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
But anyone stay here won't be left tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence filled the air.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The light.
The world's highest expressway has opened to traffic in China's Tibet Autonomous Region. It is nearly 300 kilometers long and has an average elevation of 4,500 meters. It connects the cities of Nanchu and Lhasa, shortening the travel time from 6 to 3 hours. The road passes through many picturesque areas such as snowy mountains, grasslands, and wetlands. The expressway is also environmentally friendly. Special passages have been devised for animals to get from one side of the freeway to the other. The youngest panda at the U.S.'s Smithsonian Zoo, National Zoo that is, has turned one. Baby panda Xiao Qiji celebrates the milestone by eating a specially made fruitsicle cake with his mother, Mei Xiang, in Washington, D.C. Both pandas dug into their icy cake, an ideal treat in the hot and humid summers of the U.S. capital. Xiao has captured hearts and had many first-time experiences. Some of them include sliding and tumbling around in snow and recognizing his name, which translates to little miracle in English.
He was born during the pandemic, and given the age of his mother, we didn't think she'd have another cub. And the fact that we, not just that we had this miracle, but he has just been, he's given people moments of pure joy and pure happiness.
Xiao Qiji is the fourth surviving cub of Mei Xiang. Its older siblings now live in China under an agreement with the United States. Pandas have been reclassified from endangered to vulnerable Thanks to reforestation to expand habitats in which the species can survive, there are an estimated 1,800 giant pandas in the wild.
The annual Buddha sculpture has been unveiled at the New York State Fair to the delight of eager spectators. The artwork was sponsored for the 53rd year by the American Dairy Association. It was carved out of 400 kilograms of butter and took 10 days to build. The sculpture is dedicated to the children who will be going back to their normal lives after the coronavirus pandemic is over. Once the fair ends, all of the butter will be broken down and turned into renewable energy. Switzerland is constructing its biggest alpine solar plant in an effort to secure renewable energy throughout the year. The 2.2 megawatt plant is expected to be completed by the end of 2021. The Mutzi site will include nearly 5,000 solar modules and produce around 3.3 million kilowatt hours of electricity. It will have the option of delivering half of its production during the winter when temperatures drop to sub-zero levels in Switzerland. The developers say the project makes more environmental than fiscal sense. Currently, the country gets less than 4% of its electricity from solar power. An eatery in Japan is giving disabled people a new lease on life by including them in its workforce. Dawn Cafe uses robotic staff controlled remotely by people who are handicapped. Around 50 people with mental and physical disabilities help run the cafe. The pilots come from all over Japan as well as overseas. The venue was established with support from major companies and crowdfunding. It has become more than just a place to eat for its customers.
Customers here are not exactly coming to this location just to meet the Orihime robots. They come here because of the people behind Orihime, and they will come back to see them again.
For Kentaro, Dawn Cafe has a very personal touch. In his childhood, he was left unable to go to school due to a period of bad health. Now he aspires to come up with ways to further the inclusion of disabled people in society. Crowds of visitors and conservationists have been delighted by the birth of a rare orangutan in the Spanish town of Fuengirola. The new residents of the safari park made its first public appearance 2 weeks after its birth. The baby, yet to be named, is the only one to be born in a European zoo over the past 12 months. The park has launched a program to conserve Bornean orangutans that are considered as a critically endangered species. Their population has declined by more than 50% over the past century. Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea, while 5 didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs, and being caught in fishing gear.
A Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludwig Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. Some 14,000 caves are buried under the green forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Yeah, astronauts.
Astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the little dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. Some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except their scanned references in archaeology books. Now scientists have discovered that the giant mammals could walk incredibly long distance. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground in its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. To come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
A After an epic 17-month journey that drew international attention, China's famous herd of wandering elephants has finally returned home. Wildlife protection officials said the elephants safely crossed a bridge over the Yuan River to reach their protected habitat. The Asian elephants also received a little encouragement from wildlife rangers to help them get home. Staff used corn trails as bait and built artificial roads to ensure the herd took the right route. The 1,300-kilometer odyssey that began in March captivated audiences with several highlights. One of the highlights was the birth of a calf in November. In June, drone footage was captured of the 14-member herd as they were sleeping outside of a village. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain prove that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of batik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now a skillful artist in her workshop who designed colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite a tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive.
Simple question.
Is Britain confused over COVID? For 18 months, the public has been given varying instructions about the management of the coronavirus pandemic. Everything from social distancing through to wearing of masks has been the subject of government edict, as ministers relax rules only to reimpose them. This has led to general confusion about what's guidance, what's important, and what's the law.
Many question why they can't travel when they've been fully vaccinated, when this was supposed to be their way out of the restrictions on social interaction and travel. This has turned airports into ghost towns and crippled the travel industry. To make matters worse, explosive messages leaked by the British Prime Minister's former aide, Dominic Cummings, allege that Boris Johnson originally refused to take the country into lockdown because the people dying are essentially all over 80. Meanwhile, the government's track and trace app has forced hundreds of thousands of people a week into self-isolation, a pingdemic that has caused many to simply delete the app rather than find themselves isolated from work, friends and family. This mass isolation has led to labour shortages, cancelled public transport and empty shelves, all due to a lack of staff.
So how does the public feel about the continuing restrictions, even for the fully vaccinated? And to what extent have the actions of individual ministers affected the behaviour of the general public? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. To what extent have the continuous rule changes, for example, about social distancing, affected the level of understanding or the level of confusion amongst the public? That's what we asked the people in London. Here's what they told us.
I think I probably did very vaguely for about 2 days in March 2020. But to be honest, I don't. And I don't really watch the news much anymore because it's just very, very depressing and it doesn't make a lot of sense. And you've got to that point where it's so frustrating that, to be quite honest, I've given up.
Not massively. As far as I understood it, we were now down to the great British public's common sense.
I thought they were going to keep stuff in. But I think they've changed it now, so there's nothing, and now, but there's still places saying that they want them. So I don't know what I'm doing anymore. So, yeah,
they do change quite a lot. It's difficult to follow them sometimes, but I think most people are getting the hang of it. People seem to be a bit more polite when you're crossing the street or passing on the path. So
it's now confused beyond to prepare. I think the mixed messages have been non-ending. They stopped the daily briefings. All the devolved governments are following their own instructions, their own rules, and they have done throughout COVID. So I think it's become very confusing for people. I think most people think it's over, and I think they're behaving accordingly, and they're not really paying attention to anything, certainly anything that central government at Westminster is saying now, because of the inconsistency, the shambolic nature of the messaging, the double standards. They don't trust what Boris Johnson or central government is telling them when it comes to this virus. And they know that since the vaccines have been rolled out to 60% of the adult population double vaccinated, they've left medical science behind and they're now following a course that's driven by ideology, the ideology of the market. So they're carrying out a large-scale experiment for public health, and they've now gone back to their original plan, which is herd immunity.
I think what we've got here is that people are rightly suspicious of
Dominic Cummings, but you know, when thieves fall out, honest men prosper. And what we're seeing here is that two people who were thick as thieves as the beginning of this crisis are falling out, and through their dispute, and a lot of facts that we saw throughout the narrative of the pandemic are being confirmed. You know, it was very interesting that, you know, Boris, for example, has said during the pandemic he was governed by capitalism and greed. And at the start of the pandemic, before we were starting the first wave proper, we had Dominic Cummings, who had been caught on record on the Sunday Times saying essentially the government's strategy was herd immunity, protect the economy, and if a few pensioners died, so be it. And now we've got added to that Cummings himself saying that the Prime Minister was saying, let the bodies pile high.
What does the public think of the restrictions on travel? And does it make sense to force individuals to quarantine, even if they're fully vaccinated, or indeed, if they've fully recovered after having experienced COVID-19?
I think it's, we were reflecting on this in the car when we were travelling up. The fact that we could go abroad last year, unvaccinated, and now, of course, you know, it's great to be in London for a vacation, but it's not where we would have chosen to go. So, I mean, there's a massive irony in that, but I think it's ridiculous. And we're trying to find a way forward so that our daughter can go abroad to study. And it's incredibly complex. I find myself reading and rereading the guidelines on, you know, over and over again. And they do seem to shift all the time.
I do understand that previously there's been probably a few problems with travel that have allowed the things like the Delta variant. So people will be a bit cautious. And I do understand that. And I do understand that in other countries who have had less vaccinations, it's not a great idea to knowingly perhaps transport COVID to those countries or make it worse. So to be quite honest, I don't see anything wrong with us avoiding travelling for a little. I'm a big traveller. I travel to Asia two or three times a year if I can, and I haven't been able to do it, but you just accept that, don't you? For a few years, we've got to be a bit more patient, I think.
Yeah, I'm fine with having limitations on it, because it's not just about us, it's about the countries we could take it to. And just because I'm vaccinated and like you, I've had it, doesn't mean I can't take it somewhere else. So I'm fine with there being some limitations. I actually felt they were quite slow to limit people going backwards and forwards to places like India in the first place.
I understand the travel restrictions. Even if you're fully vaccinated, I still think there should be some travel restrictions because I think you can still get it, I think, or you can pass it on. But I don't. Again, I don't sort of understand the travel restrictions and when something becomes where you can't go, you can go. That's basically my understanding of it.
Depends. I don't think we'd like people bringing a different variant in, perhaps, so I can see some sort of strict point there. But, it is a difficult one, definitely. I don't know what's right. Nobody knows what's right. That's the problem, I think.
This is the worst possible government. It's landed on the lap of the British public at the most critical time in the midst of this pandemic, the greatest public health crisis in 100 years. And we have a government of rogues. And it was Edward R. Murrow who said quite presciently that a nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves. And so this is an indictment of the British public that they've voted in this man, this charlatan, Boris Johnson, and this government of opportunists and careerists. They have made a virtue of corruption. They've been handing out huge contracts to their friends in the private sector using COVID as a pretext. They've taken advantage of the shock therapy. Naomi Klein famously wrote that book, which I would encourage all your viewers to read, that these people take advantage of shocks in society in order to push through otherwise rebarbative policies and get away with corruption. And so, you know, criminal negligence is the stamp of this government. And I think when social historians look back on this period in 50 years or so, they will look back with a degree of astonishment that this government was allowed to, first of all, come to power, but to remain in power, regardless of all the missteps over COVID. Boris Johnson's appalling ratings are still high relative to his opponent, Keir Starmer. That's an indictment of the British public. It's also a very withering indictment towards Keir Starmer, the current leader of the Labour Party.
I think the answer to that's pretty obvious, isn't it? the question answers itself. We've had numerous examples of hypocrisy, and it hasn't stopped, has it? It's still ongoing.
That's the one thing that I've really hated, because just before all the restrictions finished, I got pinged and I had to self-isolate. And I was wanted to go to work because I need the money. And then when I saw that Boris Johnson wasn't going to do it, I was livid. And that's what really flipped me from, because I voted Conservative last time. That's what really flipped me. I'm not sure what I'm not voting him next time, though, so.
I don't think anyone would really believe that they are practicing what they preach. It's extremely transparent that they feel that the rules are not for them. One rule for them and another rule for us.
It's a difficult job. I wouldn't want it. Some things good, some things bad. I don't like the fact that they're giving perhaps government contracts away in a way they shouldn't do, but I wouldn't like his job. I think he's done fairly well in some respects and not in the others, definitely.
And I think it's been a slippery slope ever since Dominic Cummings and Barnard Castle. And I just think, certainly amongst the people I frequent with, I think there's little or no trust in them being the role models and them modelling what we should do as people. It absolutely feels like one rule for them and one rule for us. Absolutely.
There are different and contradictory things to say here. There's no question that the people are deeply suspicious of the early lifting of restrictions. And if you look around, most people are still wearing masks when they go outside. They haven't simply abandoned them. But I do have to say, if you look at the one thing that was done well in this country, it was the rollout of the vaccine program. We have a lot of vaccine skepticism because of the levels of mistrust of the government. And a lot of people who really should take the vaccine to protect themselves from COVID, which is a serious disease, really is a serious disease. There's no question about that. They've not taken it. And it's those people now who are falling sick. What is true is that children, certainly people under 20, are at very low risk from COVID, even if they get it. And it's principally amongst those groups, the unvaccinated and the young, who are getting COVID now. So we are seeing very large numbers. Certainly independent sage are extremely worried about those numbers and that there may be a new variant, as you say. But actually, the vaccine is effective. The vaccine program has proven to be effective. And we have essentially protected the oldest and most vulnerable. So I'm not, Saeed, an advocate of indefinite extension of lockdowns and curtailment of individual liberties. Of course, that needs to be balanced with a general good. I think a persuasive, inclusive policy of trying to persuade people who are vulnerable to be vaccinated would be the best thing. We have huge numbers of alienated and impoverished people who are refusing to protect themselves because they mistrust the government. I think this is the biggest issue at the centre of this question.
Let's look at the facts. By the end of July 2021, according to government statistics, 129,500 COVID-19 deaths had been recorded in the UK, with a total of 5.8 million identified cases of the disease recorded in the same time. Meanwhile, the pandemic continues. In the week up to the 21st of July 2021, 689,313 people had been forced to self-isolate in a single week, causing massive labour shortages nationwide.
How does the public feel about WhatsApp messages leaked by Dominic Cummings that appear to show Prime Minister Boris Johnson demonstrating little regard for over 80-year-olds who have died or risk dying from COVID-19?
That's what he says. I don't know whether we can trust him because he done one thing and they're all the same. They say one thing and do another. So it's what to believe, I don't know. That's the trouble.
I think we only know about 3% of really what's going on with these leaks. I think there's a Machiavellian enterprise that one day will all unravel. But to be quite honest, I wouldn't be surprised if Boris Johnson is leaking things about himself in a very, very complex way. I think it's a tip of the iceberg, and I think you just have to ignore really what is being said in this. It's a game being played out by a few politicians for their own benefits, not for ours.
I don't know what he believes. I don't know what Cummings believes. But the fact that they're willing to dish the dirt on each other just shows you the kind of characters we're dealing with, doesn't it? I'm not surprised, and even from the joke memes, they seem to just get the tone spot on. it would seem that there's a private face to what the government says, which is pretty shambolic. And there's the, you know, there's the face that amongst themselves. And certainly I feel that they treat us with little, with contempt, really.
I'm not surprised, but then again, I don't really trust what comes out of his mouth either, so I don't trust anything at the moment, so.
They're in a difficult situation. It's difficult to read the nation at present. Working people have absolutely fallen out of love with the Labour Party, and therefore there is no national scale opposition. And while some people are struggling to build one, I myself have been a part of that. I think George Galloway has been a part of that. The election result at Batley and Spen was very significant. There's not been a left candidate who's come and received 20, 25% of the vote in any election for 100 years. So Labour have held this monopoly as the second British political party. They are just being disintegrated. And as a result, people are simply voting for the only party which is there, in their opinion, in most elections, which is the Tory party. So they're almost indemnified against their own failure, you know, by the current political dynamic. It's for the working people to create a force that can change that. At the moment, there's little sign of it, of course. And there was the Aylesbury by-election, in which the Tories were defeated by the Liberal Democrats. There's a deep malaise and a deep discontent, essentially, with worsening standard of living, which has been happening really since the 2009 crash, and has only been made more profound and will keep on getting worse over the unfolding years. But until there's a political expression for that that can challenge the Tories electorally, they're kind of sitting back and wondering how they're getting away with it at this point.
I'm not surprised in the slightest. It doesn't come to me as a shock. I don't think it will come to anyone with any scintilla of political consciousness or who understands what Boris Johnson is and who he is and how he operates and how he thinks. This is an eaten, educated fanatic, and he has little, scant regard for public health. We know that he was resistant to the idea of a second lockdown in the winter. He said, let the bodies pile high. This is coming from Dominic Cummings, who was then his chief advisor. The man's a disgrace. He has a stone in his chest where his heart should be, and he's shown that throughout this pandemic.
Does the public have any idea when the pandemic restrictions will finally be lifted? Or do people fear that these limitations on civil liberties, including vaccine passports and travel restrictions, will be in place forever?
I think it will change, definitely. It's just given it time. As long as no more variants come in or another strain of something comes in, I think you can't control us forever that way. It's no good for the economy. It won't do any good for anyone, so we can't stay in it forever, definitely not.
Eventually, I think this is going to be around in some form or another, with some kind of restrictions for maybe 4 or 5 years. Who can see beyond that? I'm not a scientist. I really don't know.
I think we'll be living with it for a long time. There does seem to come a point where you have to jump one way or the other, I think. But certainly it seems like we are reaching a form of, almost by accident, a form of herd immunity. But I think certainly the people, I think people wish to still wear the mask and still keep their distance. So I think it'll almost be pushed by the public more than central government. I think that's certainly way it feels. Certainly where I live in Bristol, it's the compliance is still really, really strong. Even though you go into a shop, people say you don't have to wear a mask, but you know, people do.
I hope so. But part of me deep down thinks no, but can but hope.
Not forever, but for a long, long time. I reckon another 3 years at least before it's perhaps to what it was in 2019, 2020. I think we just, like I said before, we've got to hold our breath and be patient, because it's going to take a long time to work its way out, I think.
I understand the argument, and certainly if you look at a lot of people independent sage, they will have a similar problem to you. I think that we're not going to see hugely increasing rates of vaccination. Now we're getting to the point where GPs are returning vaccine to the vaccine program, because actually the people they're offering it to at this stage are the ones who do not want to have it. So what we've now reached is probably we're getting close to the limits of the people who will voluntarily accept vaccination. The question is whether we're going to coerce them or persuade them. I would advocate persuasion. It seems as if our government are going down the lines of coercion, which will create further problems and compound the inequalities. In terms of the world, this is far from over. Okay, if we look at Indonesia, they've only vaccinated perhaps 5% of their population. The only country throughout this pandemic, or one of the few countries, there are others, who managed it really well, at China, who had an initially very stringent lockdown in the areas affected, targeted response, graded response across their community, used technology, mobilized their resources to deal with it, and through public health measures prior to any vaccination were able to achieve zero COVID. I have total sympathy with the people from independence age experts who essentially think we should achieve independent COVID. But we have to recognize that within our socio-political system and with a government and an economy that are totally unwilling to make the changes to achieve that, whilst we can criticize and say we shouldn't have started from here, we are where we are. And actually the only effective tool we've had is vaccination. Vaccination has worked for us. What we really need to do is vaccinate the rest of the people. Yes, there can be further variants. Actually, we've seen that vaccines are effective against all the variants that we've seen so far. So this is something to monitor, but not something to radically change our perspective, in my opinion. But the other countries, yes, we need urgently to allow them to deal with it. They haven't got social systems that have allowed them to achieve zero COVID. They're getting massive waves, as we've seen in Indonesia, as we've seen in India.
Right.
And that is a system, that is the system of global inequality that is also inherent to our world today that we're dealing with, rather than a medical problem.
Well, I'm following the medical science. I'm not following Boris Johnson. It was Boris Johnson or his government that was telling me that I had to do these certain things in order to manage COVID. Then I would be asking serious and cynical questions. But I think we have a problem. We have a crisis of media information, and we have a crisis when it comes to the growing traction of conspiracy theory, because we now have some of these conspiracy theory cranks, and they are cranks, they're anti-public health cranks, who are now turning their guns on the NHS. There was a demonstration in London just last weekend where some of the speakers were comparing NHS doctors and nurses to Nazi doctors and nurses that were working in concentration camps in the Second World War. You could not believe it. This is where we are now. This is a debased culture, and the conversation around COVID has been absolutely horrific on the fringes, but it has a growing traction with otherwise intelligent people now believing that this is some sort of encroaching fascism. Wearing a mask is an unacceptable imposition, and social distancing is the start of some kind of lurid conspiracy in order to keep us under control in some kind of open prison in the World Economic Forum and Bill Gates and you name it. So there have been a lot of casualties of COVID, those who died of the disease, those who suffered long COVID, but there's also been casualties of those who suffered a collapse in intelligence and their nationality.
There is increasing anger and frustration about the limits on international travel, with people losing confidence in their ability to understand what they're allowed to do. They fear that if they do book something, they'll end up high and dry abroad or facing quarantine at home. With the additional revelations of messages by Dominic Cummings about his former boss, the Prime Minister, which seemed to suggest Boris Johnson was not very worried about elderly COVID-19 deaths, many question how seriously the government is taking the impact of the disease on the elderly and infirm.
There is a risk that the government will lose the cooperation of the British public through inconsistency, confusion, and the fact that ministers themselves have set a bad example through their own behaviour. For Britain and for the world, the COVID-19 pandemic is far from over, but it's quite possible that the British government is losing the faith and authority over the British public to handle this serious situation.
IRIB English Radio.